My name is Tom Brucker, and I grew up in Ohio in a little town called Yellow Springs, and I fooled my music teacher into thinking I could read music, but really all I could do was memorize music and sing along very well with the sopranos. And I went to Oberlin College, and Oberlin, of course, has a conservatory of music, and I was a geology major, but I was really lured down the street to the conservatory where I did recordings of student recitals and things like that. And we made tapes for the students to hear their own performances. And that kind of grew into concert sound. And the more I got into it, the more I enjoyed it. So I couldn't major in recording or sound, but that was where my heart was. And after school, I worked there a couple years. And then we had a terrible winter in Ohio in 77. And I moved down to Nashville because there was plenty of music down here in the music business and the studios. So I spent a day visiting a couple of the manufacturers that made equipment, because that was sort of my main interest. I had no studio experience, and nobody was hiring, so my backup was to work in a stereo store fixing stereos. And so I landed at Anderson Audio and drove back to Ohio, got my stuff, loaded it up, brought it down here.
How about that? 77. Pretty sleepy town at that point, but
it was a very friendly town.
Friendly, and it had a music business, of course, and it had country and a little bit of gospel. What did you know about the music, and how much did you care about the music?
Almost nothing. I mean, one of my favorite bands, well, not favorite bands, but we were exposed to Area Code 615 in Bob Dylan's Nashville Skyline. So that was about it, other than country stuff that crossed over Ode to Billy Joe and stuff like that. So
yeah. And did it surprise you a little bit that you got into the insides of the machinery and the soldering irons and the knowing how the electrical work, or had that always appealed to you?
Well, lacking direct knowledge of anything other than live concerts, in classical music, it's a very different thing from rock and roll or anything. But I probably had no choice. I don't think anybody would have had me do anything other than punch buttons on a tape recorder or something like that had I gone into the studio. I started out at the stereo store and received tons of training, because back then there were good margins. You could make money, profit, selling stereo equipment. And so the manufacturers had money to spend on training the people that would be repairing the equipment. So I was either well-trained or brainwashed. I'm not sure which it was.
But your shop sold new stuff and took in people in a sort of showroom environment? How different was it?
Yeah, I worked for a stereo store down on 21st Avenue. Mm-hmm. So there were a cluster of four different stores down there, all competing for the same customers at the foot of Vanderbilt. And so it was a... when I came to town, there were at least seven stores selling stereo equipment at the time.
Each one
had its own personality and sort of a sales approach and things like that. So,
can you tell me a little more about what you observed about how that business interfaced with the public, its ethos, how it ran versus now?
I started out in what was called a specialty dealer, and the job of the specialty dealer was to educate the customer and show them equipment that cost more money, and then give them three or four good reasons why they should buy that instead of going down to Dixie Hi-Fi and just buying whatever was on sale. And so it was had a strong element of education, I've always sort of been attracted to educating people, and probably talk too much when a customer has a question. I'll just go on and on. But the environment those first couple of years, everyone in the store was young, and when you're young, you just don't know what your limits are. So we were selling the first big screen TV in the U.S. market. It was an Advent. And Of course, I had to repair those. I knew nothing about them, but I soon learned. And what was kind of fun in Nashville is you either had customers who were rich people who could afford stuff like that, or crazy people who had to have something like that. And so I actually got to go to the stars' homes and sort of get their TV going and chat with them a little bit. And, I mean, it's mind-blowing, but I once repaired Roy Orbison's TV, and I didn't know much about Roy Orbison other than Pretty Woman. And so I certainly didn't come to his house equipped with any kind of questions that would pester him. And so we chatted a bit, and the whole time he wore his dark glasses. And I encouraged him to keep going, and he told me that he was doing some production projects. And that was kind of fun, and then I left.
I figured that must have been happening throughout. In the 60s, hi-fi was a lifestyle assumed. It was very baked into the good life and sort of bourgeois aspirational things. Is that what you kind of found in the sales environment and the conversations with people? I'm really trying to get at that.
For young adults, hi-fi replaced cars. So in the 50s, you'd spend a bunch of money putting glass packs on your car and drive around the drive-in, and with the windows rolled down and the car packed full of people, and that money shifted over to getting a nice stereo, and of course you could get records. Records were exploding. Records got very, very interesting starting in about 1965, and I think as records got interesting, stereos got better, and as stereos got better, records got better. So there was a kind of a bootstrap phenomenon where everything got better, and in the late 60s, something called high-end audio appeared, and my geology professor happened to have a high-end stereo, which means it's expensive and it's equipment that most people would never have in their own home, but he loved to listen to different records and try different pieces of equipment, so we'd go over his house and try and listen, I was kind of introduced to this idea that maybe it could be a hobby, especially that there was some quality to different kinds of sound that was worth aspiring to. In other words, you mentioned bourgeois, which a lot of the high-end stuff is expensive, but I think there was also an aspect where people that had these stereos loved to share them with people. You know, come on over to the house and listen. And so we had a little group of four people that listened. So one remained a geology professor. The other three are very much involved in audio. I mean, it was a hugely influential, you might model it as a think tank or something like that. But we ended up making careers out of those living room sessions with the Klipshorns and listening to Tarkus and Gordon Lightfoot.
Very interesting. I remember my first experience would have been a friend of my dad was a law professor at Duke, and he had the family friends who fellow was a physician, and he was clearly as part of his overall, acquisitive lifestyle, had a fancy stereo, but he had reel-to-reel tape. So one night at dinner, the kid and I must have been eight or something, we were all like, okay, put it on. And I didn't have my sort of, oh, that's amazing moment then, but I was aware that somebody was sort of showing off your stuff or sharing it. And hopefully there's a fine line between those two things, right? But it was only later, early on in Nashville at Nicholson's Hi-Fi, that I hear a system that truly just shocked me, that made me feel inside my nervous system, and it was just truly astonishing. And it's an experience that without a showroom culture and put the showrooms in places that people are likely to just wander in and say, oh, I've never tried this before, it has a harder time spreading. I also, over time, it seems like the Well, let me ask it this way. It is so striking to me to learn that late 70s Nashville had more, had a stereo, an audio district with more dealers than sell hi-fi equipment in the entire, you know, county today. What does that say?
State.
Yeah.
Maybe more than the state.
What do you think's happened there?
Well, it was profit margin, and high stereo turned into a commodity, and it's tough to, you know, the bigger you are as a store, the more customers you. So it's the Walmart syndrome, and each of the stores tried to establish its own little niche and faded out one by one. There was never really a consolidation to any extent. I mean, you're not going to get rich selling stereo. You're going to make a lot of friends.
It is a social network kind of an operation.
Yeah. Hmm.
Well, tell me about the origins of this remarkable place. When did you go into business for yourself?
Well, I switched to another dealer when the company I was working for was faltering. And I worked for them for about 4.5 years. And then they were going to outsource their service, or to actually just sell that division. And so a partner and I said, well, can we buy this? And they said, sure, you can buy this. And so we went into business. And of course, with a liberal arts education, you sort of don't know what you don't know. And business seemed like an easy thing to do. And we started our business inside a store, literally just renting space. And then eventually that store closed, so I moved the business over here along with my partner to be near the other store, which is down the road. And that store changed hands, and our relationship broke up. So we shifted. At that time, VCRs had gotten affordable, and we had the demand for VCR repair, and it was through the roof. And so for a service company, it was kind of a profit center. And we kind of ebbed and flowed as the technology and what consumers were buying would change. So, you know, the stereos were always where my heart was, but it was in the background. And we did VCRs, and I got laid into projection televisions and things like that. And we did camcorders and car stereos and portables, and Walkman and Discman, and the CD came out. And I mean, it just each year there was a new technology, and we'd have to sort of learn how to repair it and learn the quirks, and then also see how people would be using the equipment. And I always enjoyed doing car stereo, because when people listen, it tends to be in their car. And that's a radio thing as well. I mean, gosh, people don't listen to radio at home. They do now, but boy, in those days, everybody listened to it in the cars until the CD changers came along, and then they switched to 6 discs in a package.
Yep. Yeah, there have been so many new product lines, and then proliferation within those product lines. You went through the sweep of it pretty well.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this actual physical location opened when?
We've been here 33 years. So part of it is it's a really busy part of town. It's easy to get to, and there wasn't any reason to move. we could fit everything we needed to do in here.